Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And today we are continuing in our speculative episode of this show. We're going to continue looking a little bit at the questions behind MH370. I have another guest on board for the second hour. His name is Jeff McKee. Now, Jeff, apart from being a good friend of mine, Jeff is an engineer in the petroleum industry with 40-odd years of experience in that field, in oil exploration and engineering from an oil exploration perspective. And Jeff knows a great deal about the oceans and the conditions that exist in very, very deep water, such as the location where MH370 is alleged to have gone in. Jeff also knows a lot about the petroleum industry, as you might imagine, and we're going to also get into more questions about peak oil, the theory that the world is running out of oil, and we're going to talk a little more about Mike Rupert, which I brought up at the end of the last hour there, and we're going to talk about the theory of peak oil. We're going to talk about Mike Rupert's take on that, and some of the psychological aspects of the kind of doom saying cult that almost surrounds the those who believe that that we are reaching this this moment of peak oil, after which all oil reserves are going to be shrinking, and that's going to lead to some giant catastrophe. And it does lead many people to deeply disturbed states of mind. And as we've seen there, Mike Rupert appears to have committed suicide. But first, let us return to the infamous MH Flight 70 with the illustrious Jeff McKee. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Oh, thank you, Herowood. I think your intro was a little bit flattering, but nevertheless, I'm happy to talk with you because I am an admirer of your show.
Excellent. Well, I think it's great to have you on board. I think this is the first time we've had you on the show.
That's right, yeah. Probably I haven't had anything to say, but these two subjects you're talking about now, or yes, just chatting about, are immensely interesting to me.
Absolutely, and you've certainly done your research on a lot of these topics, and you are also, as an engineer, a member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, is that correct?
Yes, yeah, I am a member, and to become a member, they check out your credentials pretty carefully. You know, you've got to show your qualifications and experience.
Yes.
And then they accept you. However, the key people in Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth would be the structural engineers.
Yes.
And the architects, whereas I am a chemical engineer, but when it comes to explosives, etc., I have a general knowledge, because the instant piercing of thick steel is standard technology in the oil and gas industry. They use it underground for perforating these well bores in order to create holes to let the fluid into the riser. And of course, these explosives they use are very powerful, normally RDX, but they can shoot an instant hole about 2 or 3 meters through solid rock, as well as the steel. So the oil and gas industry, of which people like Dick Cheney were very close to,
yes,
probably world experts at methodology for piercing steel.
With that's a really
very, very high tech explosives. Yeah, so
it's a really interesting subject. I think we could do a whole show on that. I didn't actually know you knew a bit about that, but that's a really, really interesting subject in itself. But look, let's start with MH370. Now, we've had a few chats about it off air. You're of the opinion, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're of the opinion that the plane if it did crash in this very, very deep water, more than 4,500 metres deep in the Indian Ocean, if it did crash in that location, that they're not going to find anything because of the enormous pressures. And can you just basically elaborate on that a little?
Yeah, well, you know, let's face it, since 9/11, one doesn't just accept what we are told anymore. Since 9/11, the world has changed, and all these stories we get, we keep an open mind. Because so now, that's my attitude to this MA370.
Yes.
Nothing makes sense to me. And when you look at the media, they're just focusing on the daily search and whether a ping was heard here and what search. And no reporter will ever go to the area of scientific method looking at this. In other words, the scientific method has been pretty well banned by mainstream media. They've demonized the scientific method by calling conspiracy theorists. So anybody who raises a hypothesis is demonized. You're not allowed to, okay? Now, the way the scientific method works is just that. What you do is you brainstorm and you raise hypotheses based on what information you have, and then you leave the hypotheses there and put it out there and see if it can be invalidated by evidence, okay?
Yeah.
Now, the hypotheses get thrown out one by one, and perhaps at the end of the day there's one hypothesis left standing that just can't be invalidated despite people trying to. And so that remains as a hypothesis. And it could even be converted into reality once it's proven. Now, the good example, of course, is controlled demolition in the case of those three buildings on September the 11th. The hypothesis, which is still standing strong,
it hasn't
been invalidated. So people should accept that as a hypothesis, and they should think about it, whereas the people commissioned to do the research refuse to even go there, you see, and that's why the whole 9/11 thing is not scientific, because people are too afraid to even think about various hypotheses which make more sense than what we're told.
Yeah, that's a really important point, and it actually harks back to something I was saying in the first hour when we were talking about MH370, is that you start off by looking at the prima facie evidence. You look at what happened and you make a hypothesis. I didn't actually use that word, but actually this is quite correct the way you framed it. You would make a hypothesis, and looking at MH370, the most logical hypothesis to make initially on the basis of what happened is to say that the plane was stolen.
Ah, yes.
Over to you.
Yes, Nick.
Yeah.
Well, look, I don't have at the tip of my tongue all of the list of all the various hypotheses that have been put forward, but all of them are quite valid.
Yes.
And I've just got these YouTube clips coming to mind. We could run through the hypotheses, but there was an IBM engineer on the plane, and his wife was interviewed, and, of course, she spent 24/7 trying to find out what's happened. And she, in her heart, is convinced that the people are still alive. Now, of course, you can be in denial, but she was no fool, and she was saying that we're not being told what's going on, you see.
Yes.
Now, so that indicates that the plane was stolen. Now, another wacky—I wouldn't call it wacky—but another hypothesis was some nerd on the internet, some real geek who is a member of this aeroplane spotting outfit. Did you read that one where the Israelis bought a Boeing 777 from Malaysia Airlines last December? And it's currently stored. It hasn't taken off again, and it's stored in a hangar in Tel Aviv or something. So you know, there was a linkage there that maybe something was being planned for another 9/11 event that could be blamed on Iran.
That particular story, if I might just interject, that particular story is what I would call a factoid. And I'm very wary of factoids because what I define as a factoid is something that someone advances as a fact, and yet I can't verify it. There's no way of verifying it. And I find these very problematic, and you see them a lot in YouTube videos where people say, well, this happened, that happened, and you're supposed to take it on faith that they're telling you that this is true. And I differentiate in terms of my approach to this show between what we might call speculation, which is clearly presented as speculation, and fact, which is clearly presented as fact, which means it's verifiable, you know, to a high degree. Nothing's ever 100%, but you know, when we say certain things are fact, I usually like to have some references that I can back that up. But I'm very disturbed by some things that pop up where people advance factoids that they assert as fact, yet there is no way you can verify them at all.
Yeah, actually, they're very interesting. You use the word verification, okay?
Yes.
Now, as an engineer who spent 40 years in the game, it's very important to design things based. You can't base anything on opinion in engineering, opinion engineering. It's dangerous. People will die. In other words, all those people travelling in an aeroplane, right, all these ordinary people, they actually put their faith in the engineering profession that the aeroplane has been designed not on opinion but on verifiable scientific laws and fact and testing. And it's interesting as an engineer to see all these ordinary people who trust this methodology. Now, verification. Now, what I found in engineering, you know, I know that you're a bit of a philosopher. In fact, you are a philosopher.
Thanks.
The logical positivist, you know, the British empiricist, this was the Austrian school of logical positivism. It's in the field of epistemology, but it actually says that the meaning of a statement is its method of verification, and that if something can't be verified in principle, then under that school of thought, it is meaningless, okay?
Right.
In other words, now that is why my attitude to climate change, in principle, it cannot be verified what is going to happen in 50 years to our planet. Mm. And so therefore, to me, as an engineer, the whole climate change computer modelling is actually meaningless, and I'm entitled to that view. And now...
It has no method of proving it true or false, because it's a predictive model. We are just going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. I'm talking today to Jeff McKee, engineer and someone who knows a lot about the petroleum industry. So do stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. It's a great pleasure to be talking to you today. And do check us out on the internet if you get a chance. Come to our website, www.truthnews.com.au, and please grab our podcasts. I know that the Logos Radio Network does provide podcasts of our show as well, but I've had some listeners saying to me that the podcasts there are out of date. That is true. The Logos Network is very understaffed, and they're having a lot of trouble maintaining these podcasts. But don't worry, because I maintain them on my own website. So if you come to my site and you want to subscribe to my podcasts, just follow the links. It's all very clear on the homepage, and you can start getting podcasts directly from Truth News. Now, just getting back to MH370, Jeff, you were talking there before the break about verification, and I was talking about the problem with a lot of amateur reporting, a lot of YouTube style commentary, where they say certain things occurred, such as a plane with a serial number that matched the planes, and that it was seen in a hangar. And I've got no way of confirming or denying whether that's true. It's just someone say so, and I try to steer away from that sort of talk, because it might be true, it might be complete nonsense, and I've got no way of differentiating that. I've got no way of verifying it. So, but you were talking about the wider problem of verification, and some of the issues there about verifying what actually happened to flight MH370.
Yes. Before I talk about verification specifically with MA370, I can understand your position on factoids, because I've had some experience dealing with high-functioning autistic individuals, and
yes,
they have a photographic memory, right, and they can remember facts going back to year dot and thousands of facts as though they happened yesterday. Now, can you imagine a child, you know, these picture puzzles where you have a whole lot of numbered dots on a colouring book, and you connect dot 1 to dot 2 to dot 3, and gradually a picture emerges.
Right.
Can you remember those childhood games?
I do vaguely remember that, yes.
Well, if you consider that out there, there's a whole lot of dots.
Yes.
In relation to MA370.
Yes.
Now, you can connect those dots in different ways, and a different picture will emerge. And so...
Yeah.
But everybody's looking at the same dots, but they can have different interpretations. So there is a phenomena of in high-functioning autistic individuals to actually over-interpret data.
That's interesting.
And so what you can do, you can come up with a conspiracy theory by design, just by connecting a convenient number of dots and ignoring the others. So anyway.
No, it's a very, very interesting point. Yeah, sorry, continue, yeah.
Yeah, so getting back to MA370, I actually love conspiracy theories, because they're much, much more interesting than boring reality you read about in the newspaper. But that's probably one of my weaknesses. I take them all with a grain of salt, but I actually enjoy indulging in conspiracy theories.
Sure.
But with the MA, I was thinking, if they after 9/11, for example, there's clearly a inner sanctum, in the intelligence elite, there's obviously inner sanctums of people who are on a very high level, who are organising all sorts of things. And my sort of gut feel was, if you wanted to design the disappearance of a plane and have it sink in the most convenient place where recovery and verification could never ever happen, even in principle, well,
yes,
you would put the plane exactly where it is now. And all this business about we heard a beep, we picked up a beep, this is designed to kind of spread the meme that that's where the plane is,
and it was very very vague information. It was just really a trajectory. They said it could have been north, it could have been south, but it was very, very meager information, which they then chose to use to make the conclusion that the plane went down in the middle of the south Indian Ocean in some of the deepest water in the world.
Yeah, so we're getting all these kind of memes put out there. We have the Australian Air Force chief saying, I'm very confident we're going to find the black box. You know, now there's a good potential. And the language is, you know, there is a potential. Yeah. And it's all us covering language.
It's incredible, it's all, isn't it?
Yeah, and...
You were saying... I just quickly want to ask you. You were saying earlier off air about the ocean pressures that would exist at those depths. Can you just basically repeat some of that? Because I thought that was very important.
Yeah, well, look, I'm aware of ultra-deep water natural gas pipelines. There's three or four in the world that the limit is 3,000 metres, okay?
Yeah.
There's one going from Algeria to Spain. There's one under the Russian one under the Black Sea is about 2,500 metres. And the government of Timor-Leste wants an ultra-deep water pipeline from the Greater Sunrise Field across the Timor Trough down to a depth of 3,000 metres. Now, I've looked at the cost and design of those pipelines in the case of going to Timor-Leste. It is technically feasible, but there is a lot of risks. But that is the limit in the oil and gas industry. Mm. And the steel thickness has to be, at that depth, the pressure is so high, the thickness of the pipe has to be about 1 inch thick. Now, if you're going down to 4,700 metres, even one of those robots, you could do the calculations. I think the pressure, I did a calc on that Facebook post I made, but I think it was, 6,000 pounds per square inch?
Incredible,
And then the sludge down there, any debris would be buried deep under sludge. Now, if you were designing a place to disappear an aeroplane where it would never be found, that's where you would put it.
And if you wanted to trick people into believing that it had disappeared, that would be the best place to claim it had gone, because you'd never be able to be proven wrong.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it would not be, your hypothesis would not be falsifiable.
Yes, yeah.
And this, we know all about this from 9/11.
Yeah.
And that is why NIST refuses to release the input data for a standard commercial software package, which they spent 7 years tweaking the coefficients until they could get a graphical picture of, you know, one beam collapsing and bringing down the building, but but they won't release the input data because every damn structural engineer in the country who uses that software will say, hey, but they've used wrong input data here, you know.
But
it took them 7 years to twiddle with the ANSYS computer program, which is finite element analysis, until they could get that magical result. And then they won't release the input data on national security grounds. How's that?
Yeah, again, it's
a joke.
It's just a betrayal. It's a joke. It undermines the basic scientific principle. Yeah.
Yeah, and so, of course, the big joke of the Malaysian authorities is the same. They say that we promise we will release the information to the public of the black box. Okay, now they know full well the black box will never be found, you see.
Yeah.
So they made that promise to be transparent. I mean, how ridiculous can you get?
Yeah, and, you know, we've had clear evidence that there was confusion and contradiction in the narrative at the early stages, when the Malaysians were actually saying it went east, it went west, and then people within their own government were contradicting what their own military was saying, and then suddenly the Americans came in with their experts saying, oh, we found the pings, and now we know, and then suddenly the Malaysians went quiet. It was very, very odd. We are going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, and I'm talking with Jeff McKee about MH370, and we're going to get into more very interesting material, so do stay with us. Welcome back to the show. You're with Truth News Radio. And my guest today is Jeff McKee, engineer in the petroleum industry, chemical engineer, and we've been talking about the mystery of flight MH370. I'm really keen also now to get into the question of peak oil, which is something that, that Jeff, you are actually quite expert in. From your field, from a professional career. And I would love to get your perspective on it. And then we're going to talk a little about Mike Rupert, who you've also read and you've certainly appreciated some of his work.
Yes.
But you were also very keenly aware of the psychological impact of this sort of Malthusian doom cult that surrounds peak oil. So let's just get into all that, and I'd love you to just take it from the top, in whichever way you please.
Okay, right. Am I on air now?
You are indeed. Yes, you are. We're on air. Yes, you're most welcome to proceed.
Oh, well, peak oil is nothing. There's no taboo about peak oil, and if you read the prestigious oil and gas journal that all oil and gas professionals read, there's often articles in there by some of the famous peak oil exponents, particularly from a group called ASPO, or the Association for the Study of Peak Oil, and Campbell and others.
Okay.
Now what happened in 2006, Harold, the oil price was starting to creep up. Okay?
Yeah.
And that was the height of peak oil paranoia among the fringe peak oil alarmists, many of whom were retired geologists from the oil and gas industry, because once people retire, like me, they find their voice and they have freedom of expression, whereas when they are employees, they tend to toe the line, okay?
Sure.
Which might explain why one friend of ours who works for Qantas doesn't want to talk about MA-11. Because I mean that's just the way it goes. Everybody knows. You're being paid by people, and your family's livelihood depends on it, and that's how it goes. Now, where were we? Peak oil. It's very controversial, peak oil, and governments tend to downplay the paranoia because it is so serious.
Yeah.
And people who have analysed petroleum, and especially the peak oil alarmists, they can see that everything depends on oil. All our, all our transport, all our plastics, power generation, energy, and our whole society, which is undergoing exponential growth, is the whole wealth and welfare of society is built on this finite resource, okay, which is totally irrational, okay?
Yeah.
Are you with me now?
Absolutely.
In 2006, the oil price started going up and up and up, and the alarmists were vindicated. In other words, the oil price is going up. Global oil production is peaking. It's all happening, boys. This is the end of civilization as we know it. Millions of people are going to die. It's going to be a Mad Max future, you know. Are you with me?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, please continue.
Yeah, and anyway, the price kept going up and up and up. And it hit about $140 a barrel. Now, if it had kept going, Gerald, I've read papers to say that once the oil price gets to about $200 a barrel, that's the end of the US capitalist system. It's just collapse territory, you know. In other words, but something has happened in unconventional oil and gas, and this was not predicted by the alarmists. So the heat has gone off the peak oil alarmist group of people.
But because of the resurgence of gas, of natural gas and coal seam gas and fracking and all this other
source. Fracking. Right. This is shale. There's enormous resources now of shale oil and gas. It's just enormous.
Yeah.
I mean, something like 10 trillion barrels of oil equivalent, and we've only used 1 trillion since the dawn of the oil age, you know. So basically the peak oil alarmists are now sort of on the back foot, and so what they say is, yeah, we were right, the conventional oil has plateaued, but, you know, the heat has gone off the peak oil movement. It's very similar to the, if you remember back, I don't know what you're doing in about 1982, Harold, what were you doing then?
I was, I was just out of school. I wasn't really, I did actually have a brief stint, believe it or not, when I left school, I had a brief stint in the oil exploration industry, oddly.
Oh.
I actually worked for a while for a company that does seismic exploration.
Wow.
That was a interesting year.
This just adds to my awareness that you seem to be what is called a Renaissance man.
Yeah, I try my hand at a few things, I'm probably an expert at nothing. But I've tried to be good at doing a radio show, and I keep trying at that. So anyway, but look, Jeff, what you said there is really, really important. I believe the importance of the natural gas and shale oil and gas, and obviously coal seam gas is very important. But of course, that is again another source of alarmism for the environmental industry, or sorry, the environmental groups, because of the effect on the environment caused by fracking. And I'm certainly in agreement with that. I think that that fracking is because it's done on land that is heavily populated, is actually causing a lot of problems. But I don't want to get too much into the questions about fracking, but I just thought I'd actually just briefly address that because it is important. But the question of whether we are running out of oil, or whether, you know, whether let me try and frame it and phrase it in the correct way. The peak oil position is that the oil that is easy to get is now almost all gone, and that now there is only oil that is much harder to get. Therefore, we have reached a point of a peak in terms of the cost of oil. I've even said that wrong. It's not a peak in the cost. It's like it's going to get more and more expensive from here on, because we've reached a peak in terms of the convenience and ease of getting that oil. Now, that is the official view of those who push the peak oil meme, and I'm thinking of people like George Monbiot, who's very, very famous for his position on that. But it seems to be also countered by many other viewpoints and many other sources of information. For example, the reserves of oil in Libya, in Iraq, and in Iran are absolutely vast. They are so huge. And a couple of years ago, it was announced that they had found increased reserves of oil in Iraq that something like doubled the amount that they thought was there. And that was already a huge amount. And we hear this, and it's not widely publicized in the news, but the amount of oil that is actually available, the good quality, the sweet crude, as they like to call it, is still available in vast quantities, and the Saudi Arabians have to stop producing it to keep the price up because there's so much of it. That seems to be the other meme that I get a lot.
Yeah, well, look, God knows why America and Israel are so antagonistic towards Iran going nuclear, because if peak oil is a reality, then Iran would want to make money from its oil. And,
absolutely. We're just going to break. Sorry to cut you off, Jeff. We're just going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. With Truth News Radio. I'm talking to my guest, engineer Jeff McKee, about, we've been talking about a few subjects, started off with flight MH370. We've been talking about peak oil, and Jeff raised some very interesting points about the realities of that. And I want to, in the time we've got left today, to talk a little bit about Mike Rupert, who was a huge proponent of this sort of peak oil philosophy. And I want to talk about the psychological implications of the belief in the doom and gloom associated with the belief. So, Jeff, this is something you've got quite a lot of knowledge about as well.
Yeah, I have, yeah.
So, yeah, please please continue. Take it as you wish.
Well, ask... Yeah, ask me a question.
Indeed. Well, let's begin with Mike Rupert, because you've got you did a bit of reading of Mike Rupert. What do you think about Mike? Sadly, he's died, and it's widely believed that he committed suicide. What do you think about that?
Well, Mike Rupert, I do admire him. He in 2006, as the peak oil alarmism was taking off in a very big way, Michael Rupert was undoubtedly the world leader on getting people shit scared about peak oil. Now, what he did cleverly, he linked peak oil to 9/11.
Yeah.
And there was a mega conspiracy, which, you know, it is connecting the dots in a way which is quite credible, but America going into Iraq because they were aware of global oil supplies starting to plateau, and that would mean the end of the American economy. So anything is justified from these neoconservatives to keep the empire going. That's how it works. Now, he was brilliant. See, he was a detective with the FBI, and of course he uncovered the CIA drug running. So he had very good information on the heroin coming out of Afghanistan. And once the Americans went in there, of course, heroin production rose astronomically. So, of course, there's been videos of American Marines loading the stuff onto Hercules, but, you know, the same thing happened in Vietnam, apparently, with Air America. I heard back in, I think it was the early 70s, that a guy went to Cambodia and he saw these Air America Douglas DC-3s picking up drugs, you know.
Yeah.
So obviously, Michael Rupert was onto something here as an FBI trained detective. Now, what happened was he did brilliant work on 9/11, particularly in the stand down of the entire American air defense system on September the 11th, 2000 and whatever, one.
Yeah.
Now, he was very, very good on that, and apparently he made some presentations to congressional committees, and then he wrote his book Crossing the Rubicon, Peak Oil and the End at the End of the American Empire or something, okay? And it was a brilliant analysis, which was very, very convincing, of peak oil being the basic underlying a narrative for 9/11 and Iraq, okay?
Yeah, can I just briefly interject, because I've I'm very familiar with this view, and you know, for a long time I kind of thought of Mike Rupert as a disinformationist, but now now I'm maybe more inclined to be a bit more sympathetic to him, but I still think he is wrong. I think it's very easy to prove that he's wrong, because Saddam Hussein was desperate to sell his oil to the Americans. He wanted to sell oil. The Americans had a very cozy relationship with Saddam Hussein, but it was the Americans that destroyed that relationship. It was the Americans that undermined it by allowing him to invade Kuwait, and then using that as a pretext to declare war, to then destroy the infrastructure of Iraq, to actually then make it harder for Iraq to pump oil. And I actually firmly believe that Mike Rupert is completely wrong, and that it is the exact opposite of what he has proposed. In fact, they were trying to create artificial scarcity. They were trying to limit the amount of oil that came out of Iraq, because that was the major threat. So I just wanted to make it very clear that I'm completely diametrically opposed to this viewpoint.
Yeah.
But actually, I'll let you pick up again. Sorry to interrupt.
I think you might have interviewed a guy from the UK who is an ex-oil man, an ex-oil executive who was in Kuwait when the oil fields were burning. Did you interview him, or was it Vinny East?
I don't recall. I don't think so, no.
No, anyway, but from my take, and I have been a guest lecturer in petroleum engineering at the University of New South Wales, and I understand the legal and fiscal regimes that the oil companies have to operate under, okay?
Sure.
Now, when you do a list of all the world's legal and fiscal regimes, the Iraqi regime prior to 9/11 was totally onerous for any foreign company, any American international oil company, to do business in Iraq, because the government take was so high. In other words, 90% of all profits would go to the Iraqi government. In essence, the whole industry there was state-owned, and no American corporation could get in there. Okay, now the invasion overturned that fiscal regime, and now we have Exxon, Shell, the whole lot in there, okay? And so that's why imperialism has to also be seen in terms of helping the US corporations. It's all linked together. So,
well, they can control it more. And what I would argue is, yes, they wanted to get in there so they can control it, but control has two different aspects. Control can mean restricting supply as much as it can mean allowing access.
Actually, well, exactly, Herowood. So this restriction of supply.
Yes.
If there was a huge demand and America wanted to keep the prices down or something, they wouldn't put sanctions on Iranian exported crude oil.
Yes.
So it's, you know, I don't understand these sanctions, and I don't understand the paranoia over Iran's legitimate right under the NPT to get into the uranium industry. It's they want to be an advanced state. I fully agree with what they're doing. And Israel, you know, the total hypocrites who've developed nuclear weapons are kind of saying that Iran is doing something evil. I mean, it's totally crazy, and you know, it's probably one of the reasons why I've given up watching TV, and I only listen to podcasts such as yours. And,
indeed, Jeff, we've only got a few minutes left. I just want to briefly touch on the psychological aspects of this belief in peak oil.
Okay,
is there anything you can say about that? Because I know you're quite passionate about it. Yeah,
you know, when you put on your Facebook that Michael Rupert is dead.
Yes.
And does anybody have any comments? And my son put a a comment there saying Michael Rupert was in a death cult.
Right. Okay. Yes, death now, cult. That's strong. It's interesting.
It is strong. Now, I actually believe that, and through deep personal experience, how Michael Rupert affected my younger son, who was extremely clever, but he crossing the Rubicon was his Bible when he was 19 years old, doing first year chemical engineering at Sydney University, a very bright boy. And during that year in 2006, in late 2005, he discovered a website called Life After the Oil Crash, and he printed out 20 pages. He'd just finished HSC, getting very high marks, and he said, "Dad, if any of this is true, we're all F, asterisk, asterisk, you know."
Yeah.
Anyway, for that year, he became obsessed with peak oil, and he ordered in Crossing the Rubicon by Michael Rupert into the Sydney University Fisher Library. And after he had disappeared, we did research, and we found he'd renewed it three times. That was his Bible. And in his suicide note, he alluded to there is no point in living in this nonsense suicidal civilization, you know. So the point is, he became a fundamentalist in peak oil, and the particular variant of peak oil was the Michael Rupert variant, which was fanaticism, alarmism, doomism, and based on connecting dots in a way which is quite rational. Okay, now, but what that does to the mind of a 19-year-old is it robs a person of any meaning in life. There's no point in getting a university degree. There's no point in getting married, having children.
Jeff, I'm afraid we are at the end of the hour. I would love to hear more about that, and maybe we'll do another show on this because it's very important. But
I could talk for approximately three or four hours.
Absolutely. Okay. Look, Jeff, it's been awesome having you on today, and thanks for sharing that information. Truth News Radio Australia signing out for the week. We will be back next week. I look forward to speaking to you then.